So we'll begin by way of review. Let's put up my little review. We'll look in the back mirror together. And just remember where we were. We saw last time where Joseph finally identified himself to his brothers, and they were so thrilled. He then sent them to home to dad and said, I want you to go home to dad. Well, Pharaoh heard about it, and he said, bring your whole family, use my royal carts, bring goodies to show our affection, tell them to leave all the stuff, the implements, might be a way to translate that, leave those things back there, literally you could translate it vessels, and just come, you will have the good from the good of the land. And so they're going to be going and living in Goshen, which is in the northeast part of Egypt and the northeastern part of the Nile Delta. But they're all to come, and so we saw Jacob was delighted to hear the news. It took some persuading, but once he realized it was all true, he said, "I'm going to see Joseph before I die." Well, that's where we left off, and it picks up then with the journey in our process to Egypt. In Genesis 46:1, so Israel, again, remember Jacob also was given the name Israel by the Lord, meaning I think God wrestles for him. In other words, Jacob, you've been one who's done it on your own strength all your life. But when he met the Lord at Peniel, God said, I'm going to change your name to Israel. The Lord will wrestle for you. And so when we see the name Israel, that's emphasizing that the Lord's enabling. So Israel took his journey with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Here we see the sons telling him, and you can see that finally Israel, Jacob, recognizes Joseph's alive, and they load up what they have in the carts, and they had sheep, goats, cattle. When it says leave your stuff, some of the common clay pots, some of the basic tools, those things could be acquired in Egypt. But their household goods and such, they took. And they started in the process. They were, and which is, as you can see, west of the Dead Sea, about in the center of the Dead Sea, in the Judea. And they went down south to Beersheba. This is where Isaac and Abraham also had lived. And when you read in the Old Testament, often you'll see Israel described as from Dan to Beersheba. Dan's the farthest northern city, and Beersheba the farthest southern. So they went down to Beersheba. And we're told that in that place, he went to worship. And so we saw that there he went and worshiped the Lord. Built an altar, offered animals. And here's what happened. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. And so he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make you of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. So it says it happened in a night vision. I'm gathering what that means is they went as far as Beersheba and probably camped out, had a time of worship. And in that night, God spoke to him. So here's a question for you. What promise make? So there's a question. And while I'm asking you that question, it's a good time to remind you. Check in with Barb. Let us know you're here. Let us know who's with us. And start thinking about and texting away. What promises do you see in our time? God has, Jacob has come. He's worshipped. The Lord has spoken to him. And promises to him as he prepares to go into the new land. So think about that. And here was Jacob contemplating what God was telling him. I don't know when the last time was that God spoke to him. Of course, he did at Peniel. He did up at Bethel. It wasn't necessarily a common thing, but as he gathered to worship, with his family and as they were leaving the land. That must have been a challenging thing for him. Leaving the land of promise to go into Egypt. Not just to camp out. He's bringing everything. But God gave him some assurances. What promises does God make to Jacob? Do you have some for me? Barbara, is your phone buzzing away with answers?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll start. If you give me the easy ones.
Here's one. Rich and Carolyn say, I will make you a great nation.
Oh, you're right with me. Good. He'll make of you a great nation. Now, that's going to be significant even in the chapter as we read to the end of verse 30. We won't read the whole chapter, but we'll see, we'll talk about what that looks like. God's going to make a great nation. What else is promised? And by the way, that's significant because we're going back, think of back to Genesis 12 and 15 and 22, the promise promises to Abraham and the restatements to Abraham and others of the patriarchs. A nation was part of it, many great nation. And so God is saying, I haven't abandoned that promise. I will make of you a great nation. Yes.
From Jacob. God will make them into a great nation, and he will lead them down and bring them up safely.
That is an important distinction. Not only will he lead them down, he'll bring them back. Now, he told Abraham it's going to be 400 years. And probably Joseph or Jacob knew something, remembered of that. But that's very good, Jacob. And I guess it would fit that Jacob would know about that. That he would bring him, God would go with him and bless him and bring him back. Good.
And just so you know, everyone's with you. George and Susan, Doug, Keith, Becky, Deanna, and Tina.
All right.
And Deanna, again, all said the same thing.
Good. So here's some others. You have other ideas. I will go down with you. Remember, that's one of those key promises. God with us. I will be with you. Remember the name of the Messiah that's given in Isaiah 7:14, and he shall be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. That's an amazing promise, and especially when you think of the pagan gods, they were usually identified by specific locales. The god of the tree, the god of the river, the god of that mountain, the god of whatever. This God is the God of all. And so he can go with them. He's not limited to just Canaan.
Question from George and Susan. If God renamed him Israel, why does he call him Jacob?
That's a good question. Why is there kind of the back and forth? And this is really interesting. God renamed Abram and called him Abraham from Abram, which means exalted father, which probably was a reference. He changed his name to Avraham, which means father of a multitude, which is kind of funny because he had two sons. But it was a statement of promise. But from then on, he was called Abraham, never Abram again. With Jacob, and I think this would be true of anyone that God changes his name, Jacob, it's still 50, it's back and forth, back and forth. Many commentators believe, as they look at that and see them all in context and look at that, when he's called Jacob, it's emphasizing you're back to wrestling to make it happen. That's Jacob, the I can do it, God, leave me alone. Where when he calls him Israel, he's trusting the Lord to fight the battle for him. And so that's a clue. I don't know if we can be dogmatic. It's that case it's that situation in every case. But usually watch what he's called, and that goes, that you follow that through in the centuries to come in the prophets. When Israel is called Jacob, that's saying one thing. When Israel's called Israel, that's saying something, usually that's a clue. of the character of the that's being addressed. Do you have other questions?
No, but I'm just wondering if that's true. That's verse 1 and 2 where he has different names. Is he doing something? Is his character different in those two verses?
Oh, it would help if I went to chapter 46. You know, there we go. So Israel took his journey with all that he had, came to Beersheba. Then God spoke to Israel and called him Jacob, Jacob. That's a good question, you know, and that would be one of the questions we might think about. Is he there just speaking to him? Okay, he's calling him Israel, but saying, Jacob, Jacob. Is that just because that's his, you know, long-term name, or is he emphasizing, Jacob, trust me, I will go with you. You're not doing this in your strength. That's a possibility.
David added to the promises that God makes and said, Joseph will put his hand on your eyes.
Joseph will put his hand on your eye. Here was, by the way, so notice I broke the Jacob who called in said, I will go down with you. I will bring you up. I put them as, you know, I mentioned that as well, but separately. Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. Do you see that what he's referring to there is, you know, that's a kind of a ritual of death. What he's saying is, you know, one of the things that people were anxious then, will I be alone? Will I be apart from family? And he says, you'll see Joseph and you will die in his loving presence. So I think, so that's actually a reassurance for a believer. Death is not something we fear. Death is entrance into God's presence. And so he can speak of that in a reassuring way. You will die, not alone, but in the presence of your family, and especially the Joseph who has been apart from you for so long. Some wonderful reassurances to him. As he's getting ready to leave, he speaks words of reassurance. We're going to come back to that, and you might even be thinking big ideas. Kind of, we're going to think about the lessons at the end of this. What's the significance of this visit to Jacob? Make yourself some notes, and we can talk about that. Moving on. Then Jacob arose. Oh, no, we're back to calling him Jacob. From Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob. Do you see that back and forth? Jacob, their little ones, and their wives in the carts, which Pharaoh had sent their livestock and their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and they went to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his sons' sons, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Here's another question for you. So what does this tell us about Jacob's departure, as it's described in verses 5, 6, and 7.
While you're waiting for that answer, we have an answer from Cheju for your last question about the names. Could it have been that Jacob was troubled when he sacrificed at Beersheba and God was addressing his anxiety by calling him Jacob?
Perhaps. So, you know, I think partly what's going on here in this time of worship is I think Jacob is anxious. He senses that the Lord is, I mean, he packed everything up. He's already left, in a sense, his home, but he's leaving the promised land. Abraham had problems when he went down to Egypt. When Isaac left to Gerar from the promised land, he had problems. Should he, you know, is it okay? So I think he's probably anxious. This has been a very difficult time. How is it going to go? I'm taking my whole family, I'm taking them down into to ungodly Egypt. Is this okay? And so I think that he must have been wrestling, and God was speaking words of comfort to him. So maybe the Jacob is kind of saying, Jacob, I've got this. You don't have to be the one wrestling. I've got this. That may be what's going on here.
And from Tina and Jerry, it was a large logistical undertaking, and he brought everyone that was important to him.
Yes, and so that's one of my, it's complete. Nothing and no one is left behind. He was told, bring everything, and he did. He has them all. And that is a huge undertaking. He was a wealthy man. You know, they're driving their flocks, their herds, and we're going to come, you know, if you've read ahead, he's going to list all the individuals, or many of the individuals. It was quite an undertaking.
And from George and Susan, everyone is going. No family will be left in Canaan because judgment is coming there.
Israel is separating from Canaan. Yes. So we don't see, Judah staying with the Canaanites. We see the whole family is leaving lock, stock, and barrel out of Canaan. So I think that's significant. Good.
Now Paul says, Jacob is singular, but Israel is more plural in a sense. So Jacob took his family, Israel, which includes himself from his loins. It is called Israel today and not Jacob.
Good point. Though, as I mentioned in the prophets, you will sometimes see Israel called Jacob, and again, I think there's that use that this is good that you're. A lot of times we just read through this and don't pay attention, so that's going to make all of us be a little more sensitive as we're reading through Old Testament. Why is he calling him Jacob here? Why is he calling the nation Jacob? Why is he calling the nation Israel? What's he bringing out? But usually we think of the name Israel as the standard name for the nation. Good. And so it often has that plural connotation. Good. So it's a complete departure. We see them all loading up. It may have looked something like this. If we, I think it might have been a fancier cart than that. It might have looked like this. Sometimes I wonder if it looked like this. Possibly. But they all loaded up with everything they had. And it was a multi-day journey. And again, that's a struggle. I mean, you've got all your animals. You've got your stuff. It wasn't quick. You have children. That was all a challenge. Now, this next passage, I'm going to just let it scroll in front of you from 8 to 20-something, I think. It's just here, all these names. You can read that along as quickly as you like. And then we'll have a question, I think. So 8 to 25 lists all the individuals. I would say there are more individuals than that. In that, this is just the promised chosen family. Remember Abraham, we were told he had hundreds of servants. So this does, you know, usually when you speak of household, he probably had a household that came with him. But the emphasis here is on the line of promise, the nation of promise. Yes.
Doug mentions, Moses is writing this story, and when Moses mentions his name, he uses Jacob. When God tells Moses what to say, he addresses him as Israel.
Okay, good reminder. We always have to remember who's writing, when are they writing, to whom are they writing, and why are they writing. So good observation. So here are all the names. And can I be honest with you? This is one of those times that we want to race ahead. And I just did it to you there. I just scrolled it through, and I'll bet you most people didn't catch too many of the names. I've been through it. I made a spreadsheet with making sure I had all the names and keeping them in thought. But if you are an Israelite in Egypt, leaving Egypt, and Moses is writing this out, you kind of like seeing the name of your ancestor. This is, America, we often talk about, oh, so-and-so, they've been here so long, their descendants came over, their ancestors came over on the Mayflower. Well, the Israelites, their ancestors came down with Jacob. And so seeing all these names, that speaks to the whole nation. There we are. But summarizing that, it then comes in verses 26 and 27. All the persons who went with Jacob to Egypt, who killed his wives, were 66 persons in all. In other words, which includes wives and that sort of thing. But his specific genetic descendants, those who were actually his descendants, were 66. And the sons of Joseph who were born in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who went to Egypt were 70. So Moses lays it all out. 66 descendants came from Canaan. 2 were already were already in Egypt. They were born in Egypt. Those are the sons of Joseph. Now, if you like to see it laid out, here's what he's saying. Those who went to Egypt with Jacob, 66, then the 2 sons of Joseph, plus Jacob himself and Joseph, add it all up, 70. Okay? And again, the line of promise, you know, the inheritance is through the sons, and so that's why we're emphasizing those. So 70 came down. So here's a question for you. Are we doing okay? Any other comments, questions? Why all those names and numbers? Why do we have all that information?
While you're waiting for an answer, would you like to know who's here?
Oh, good. Let's get another roll call here. So if you leave early, say we, you might not be in.
George and Susan.
Carolyn.
Rich and Carolyn. Chris, Heidi, and children. Doug and Sandra, Mark, Cindy, and Joanna, Keith, John and Lori, J2 and Deanna, Dennis and Joyce, David and Deanna, Jerry and Tina, Doug and Sandra, Paul and Becky, and Grace and Mark.
Great to have all of you with us. Good. Excellent. So why all those names and numbers? Well, again, I've already mentioned, I think part of what's going on here is the names help the Israelites who are from then on, but especially those who are leaving Egypt with Moses as he's writing this out, that's there because they could trace their genealogy up to one of those names. And from that to Jacob, to Isaac, to Abraham. And they could see that they were in the line of promise. And so I think that was a real encouragement to those later descendants. It also emphasizes what someone else already mentioned. The whole family came. Everyone's accounted for. Everybody's on the, I was going to say shipping list, but you get the idea. All souls are accounted for. Something else I want to mention. Do you have something there? It's an amazing contrast in number with those who left. Okay, so stick with me for just a little bit. I may show you later on that when Joseph came, the date we would put on Joseph's arrival in Egypt is 1876 BC. And so when he came, there were 70 in his family. The Exodus is dated to 1446 BC. And we get this, I think I may show you this later, but we can see this from by adding up some dates of what we're told. For example, we can put that all together from various constructs. We know that, for example, the children of Israel were told in Exodus they were there for 430 years. That's if you put certain things together, and we can track that to when the temple was dedicated by Solomon, and we can set a date on that. Put that all together, and we come up with these dates. So in the time from 1876 to 1446, that 70 had grown to 600,000 men, okay, on foot, besides children. Now, the 70 was men and children, not counting the wives. So if you think about it, there's 600,000 men. Assume, I think conservatively, one wife, two children for every one man. You're looking at 2 million people. So that's what was involved in the Exodus, some 2 million people at the time of the Exodus. So a family of 70 came down. And what happened? They were a great nation when they left. They were a large family. They'd be left as a great nation.
Yes, back to your question about why the names and numbers are mentioned. George and Susan said, to maintain a record for generations to know. And Keith said, this is a historical book. Moses is showing how God's promise is being fulfilled, i.e., the sands of the seashore and the stars of heaven.
Amen. Don't get away from that. The Christian faith is a historically based faith. It's not fables and principles. It's actual people who lived in actual places and did the actual things. We can date them. We can locate all of that. The Christian faith is a historical faith. And so this is some of the historical data. Great. Good. How are we doing? Moving on then. Then he sent, that would be Jacob, he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out before him the way to Goshen, and they came to the land of Goshen. So remember, Joseph had said, I'm going to set aside this land. He sends Jacob sends Judah, who will connect with Joseph, I'm sure, show us the land. And so he goes to be the guide to this land of Goshen. But notice, Judah is rising to a place of leadership. At the end of this book, we'll be told that Judah is the royal line. King David and the Lord Jesus Christ are descendants of Judah. We see him rising in leadership. Even though Reuben was the firstborn, Judah is taking a place of leadership. And so here we can see they came down from Hebron to Beersheba, and then across, the typical route would be across, very close to the Mediterranean, towards Goshen. And of course, along the Mediterranean, you would have resources of you know, people living in those areas, trade, food, that kind of stuff could possibly be available as well.
To that last question, okay, Doug good. Says, it's so important to know the rich history of the people and who they were that God had entrusted with the lineage of Christ.
Amen. These are the ancestors of the Lord Jesus Christ. Very good. So again, it's a historical, it's places on the map. This is all, and this isn't, I know there are books out there where, like The Lord of the Rings or something, where you can, there are maps of where all these things happened. Guess what? They didn't happen. Those maps aren't real. I've taken this route. I've been on this area, in this area. You can go and visit these sites. You can go to Beersheba. You can go to Hebron. You can go to these. They are historic sites. And so there's the route that Judah was sent ahead to help them know the route to take. And so when word came, Joseph made ready. See, he's busy. He can't just take off. And so Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father, Israel. And he presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. That little verse has so much packed into it, doesn't it? Joseph made ready his chariot. He was waiting for news that they were on their way. And he raced up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. He presented himself to him. Remember, they haven't seen each other in over 20 years. And both, Joseph wondering, is my father alive? Jacob saying, my son is dead. What a meeting and what a time it was. So you can understand when you look at this next scene why it appears that Joseph was in kind of a hurry there, racing through the desert to go see his father.
Who presented to whom?
What's the question?
Who presented?
He presented himself to him. It looks to me like Joseph, so since he's the one that the subject, made his chariot ready to, and went up to meet his father, so he presented himself to him. So I would understand that that's Joseph presenting himself to his father. And Joseph, fell on his father's neck and wept on his neck a good while. So very southern, he wanted to hug his neck. But there was quite a bit of affection. I'll show you that race again. There he goes with his chariot. Looks like a scene from Ben-Hur. Okay, so chapter 46, verse 30, the end of the section will be studied, but we haven't finished our discussion. So Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I've seen your face, because you're still alive. He can die in peace, because the grief is shattered. Remember, when we saw him back in Canaan, everything's against me. Joseph is dead. Simeon he's never getting out of prison. You're going to take Benjamin from me. I am bereft. Now, Simeon has come back. Benjamin has come back, loaded with goodies. And here, can you imagine? He remembers his little Joseph, his young man Joseph, a teenager, an older teenager. He remembers him with that fine coat. But now he sees him coming. And I don't know if he would have been alone or with a retinue of guards. He sees him coming on a fine Egyptian chariot led by fine Egyptian horses, racing to him. It must have been overwhelming. And he said, I'm satisfied. I've seen you. I can die in peace.
And George says, Joseph went to his father as an honor. He yes. didn't wait for his dad to come to him.
A very good point. And Joseph is the ruler, the virtual ruler of Egypt, but he hops on his horse, if you will, and races. It was an expression of honor to his father, an expression of his own heart, spoke volumes to the Egyptians and all around him when he raced to see his father instead of waiting on his throne for his father to present himself. Very good. A lot here about his honor of his father. So it must have been, so here's, he can just almost see, is it really you? Is it really you? And so at first everyone's looking a little concerned. Then the smiles are starting to beam. What an excitement. And what a joy. And what I like about this picture, you'll see everybody celebrating. I think that's the whole point. Joseph had been working to test and refine. Are they still a bickering, divided, cruel family? Or are they a united family? And are they repentant? Well, he has seen those things, and now we do see the family is together. The family is united. The family is celebrating together. A wonderful scene. Let me throw in a little extra information for you, if I may, just some a quick historical background. By the way, it's amazing to me, those pyramids would have been quite old by the time Joseph showed up in town. It's really amazing.
I have a question.
Yes.
Why did God pick, this is from Rich, mm-hmm. Why did God pick Judah to be the bloodline to Jesus and not Joseph?
This reminds me of one of my first chemistry professor. Whenever you asked a question like that, his response would be, you ask a good question, you'll go far in science, and then he'd move on. I don't know that I can be dogmatic. Some would say, I've read some that would say, The way Judah demonstrated his character in taking responsibility for Benjamin, the way Judah offered himself as a sacrifice, like the coming Messiah, offered his life in exchange for his beloved one, some would say that that was part of why God chose him. But I think that's as far as I can go. Reuben was the firstborn. He would have been a natural, but he had a significant enough moral failure and betrayal of his father that he forfeited that. Interestingly, Joseph kind of gets the firstborn rights. In the ancient world, in biblical times, the firstborn received a double portion of the inheritance. So if there were two brothers, the estate, in a sense, would be divided into thirds. Firstborn gets two-thirds, secondborn one-third. So the firstborn always got a double portion. So what's interesting in this is that each of Joseph's sons is given a full portion of an inheritance. So Ephraim and Manasseh get as much of an inheritance as Judah or Benjamin or the others. So Joseph, because through his sons, gets a double inheritance. So in some ways, he's treated like the firstborn. But in God's sovereign will, he chooses Judah to be the royal line. And that's probably as far as I think I can go at that point. Some pointing to the richness of his character to offer himself and care for Benjamin. Very good question. Good insight.
George adds a thought there. Plus, Joseph was married to an Egyptian.
Very good point. Yeah, and so Joseph's did marry an Egyptian, and so that is something of a problem. Kind of like Ishmael was half Egyptian. Later on, when the Israelites go back, it's forbidden in the Mosaic law they cannot marry the lands, the people of the lands in Canaan, because they were such a wicked people. But the Egyptians are not on that list. But I think that's a good point too, is that Joseph married an Egyptian, and a priestly family. That's a complication. Oh, you're doing great thinking. I love to see you thinking about the scriptures. Very good. So yes.
And Deanna says perhaps Judah was willing to sacrifice himself because God enabled him.
Oh, absolutely. No, so that's the whole thing is it's not that we earn God's approval, but rather God works through us. And so God would have been the one moving in Judah. And so that would be the other way of saying it is that God moved Judah, perhaps intending his role of leadership. It was God that moved him to lead in those areas. Very good point.
And isn't it that often God chooses the weak and sinful and be his chosen vessels of mercy?
It is interesting in Scripture how often God doesn't choose the one where there's an older brother, but it's the younger brother that's chosen. For example, Jacob and Esau and others. It's God, and in fact, you'll even see when we get to the end of the book Joseph brings his sons to Jacob for blessing. All these J's get me confused. You got to watch me. He brings them and he places them. So the oldest, as I recall, is at Jacob's right hand, the youngest at his left. So in other words, his right hand blessing will go to the firstborn, left hand blessing to the second. And of all things, crosses his hands, and Joseph says to him, no, Dad, not that way. And he says, I know what I'm doing. And so, in other words, we have our idea, firstborn and all this. God sovereignly chooses in different directions. Good observation. And so that's one thing I could always just step back and say, well, that was God's sovereign will. Next question. Good. Anything else?
It's King David.
Yeah. Yeah. King David was the one no one expected. Excellent. Remember when his beloved father said, bring your sons, one of them's king. He didn't even call David into the meeting. I wonder how often David would remind him about that later on. Hey, Dad, remember? When it came time for choosing a king, you didn't even invite me? Yes. God's ways are different from our intentions. Good reminder to us. Don't always view by the outside.
George mentions, God kept his promise to Jacob by having his bones brought back.
Yeah. Yeah. We will see that later in as well. I won't get too detailed here. I've really wrestled with this. I'm not going to bog you down with which Egyptian dynasty, but let me just give you a little background here that lays some foundations. When Joseph ruled in Egypt, the Egyptians, the ethnic Egyptians, were ruling the country. They were prosperous and were actively involved in international trade. Okay, so when Joseph came in, it was Egypt. It was being run by Egyptians. It was prosperous. There was a lot of interaction with the international world. After Joseph ruled, especially up in the north, especially up in the regions of Goshen, but up in the Nile Delta and especially the northeast, Semitic or Asian Pacific Semitic peoples came down called the Hyksos people. They were not Egyptian, but they ended up taking control of especially the northern part of Egypt and ruled up in that region for a period. Now, this is sometimes called one of the intermediate stages of the kingdoms. They're called the shepherd kings. There's a lot of this. It's just an aspect of it. And here's one of the Hyksos rulers. After the Hyksos period, in the time of Moses, remember there's that statement, a king arose who did not know Joseph. So what happened is the Egyptians came back into power. They drove out the Hyksos, Semitic peoples like Israel is Semitic. And so what that means is when the Egyptians came back into power, now they had a special anti-Semitic distrust of foreigners. And so the statements made in the book of Exodus, they were fearful of the Israelites because they had become a large nation and might join our enemies. Here we have a large 2 million strong population of slave peoples who might join with other Semitics against us. And so that's why the oppression later on. So just to put it in the context, when Joseph came, strong Egyptians, friendly to foreigners. Later, Semitic people came down from the regions like Canaan and north of Canaan, actually, controlled the northern part of Egypt for a while. When they were driven out and the Egyptians came back into power, they were suspicious of the oppression. Because you would think, wait a minute, what happened? When Joseph came down, he saved Egypt. He was an honored guest. What happened? Major changes in the political realm. So, when we study our Bible, one of the questions we like to ask is, so what? What do we do with this? What are the applications? Three areas, real quickly, if you can think with me. What do we learn from the altar? And I'm going to ask about the altar and the names and something else. So what do we learn from the altar? And I see the clock is ticking along. I don't want to get too far here, so let me just start mentioning, and you could throw some in or add as well. But one thing comes to mind is when he went to the altar, he sought God's direction before he made a major decision. And I just made up a proverb for you. Before you alter, seek the altar. So before he made a big change, I mean, it was huge. This isn't, shall I move my tent? to another city in the promised land. No. Should I take my whole family out of the promised land? He went and worshiped, seeking and submitting to the will of the Lord. When we're going to make a big decision, seek the Lord. Spend some time worshiping and praying. He was concerned about leaving the land of promise, and God gave him reassurance. I think, again, it's important. We see this as a healthy time in Jacob's life, giving emphasis to the priority of worship. You know, when we get busy and distracted, it's easy to say, oh, I don't have time for worship. You can't think of a busier time than gathering up your whole massive clan, all your family, all the servants, all the stuff, moving to Egypt. What a time of anxiousness. And someone easily says, oh, I'm too distracted to worship. And he said, I'm so distracted, I need to worship. I need to spend time with the Lord and rededicate ourselves in worship and adoration. And I thought it was important, too, that he worshiped before entering this foreign land and culture. He really, I talk about, what, you know, church and church fellowship. It's a time to recalibrate and remember that God's people and God's ways, that's the norm, no matter what our culture says. And so he was recalibrating where he wouldn't have that freedom maybe there. And also was a time of God renewing his promises and God assuring him, go. It's part of the plan. Of course, we knew it was part of the plan. God announced it in Genesis 15 to Abraham. He didn't tell him it was Egypt. But this is God's plan all along. Now let's talk about those names. Some of the things I glean, why is that so important? You can jump in at any time, but for one thing, it shows God cares about individuals. We might not know any of those names. God does and knows them as individuals. We see God's care for the individual. God cares for every one of us. God will turn this family into a nation. We saw that. And no one is left behind. This is a total separation from the Canaanites. That's huge. Because I think that's a big, we'll talk about this later on in the next section when they're put off into Goshen. It's very intentional on Joseph's part, keeping them separate from the Egyptian culture that would fill them up with Egyptian immorality and Egyptian idolatry. He's setting them where they can, you know, be focusing on their identity as followers of the true God. What about the other third thing is just the whole thing of seeing Joseph. One of the things that strikes me is the value of family love. And I think George brought out just we see so much in this of Joseph honoring his father. And so I think we see God honoring. God created the family. And God honoring it through these relationships. Well, I feel like I've gone a little long, and I'm grateful for your patience. Any other comments before we leave?